From the News Centre at 5, David Cameron has defended his decision to authorise the operation to rescue British and Italian hostages being held in Nigeria, which resulted in both men being killed by their captors. That's after the Italian president said they weren't consulted about the mission. MP Eric Joyce has been given a 12-month community order, a curfew and fined £3,000 after pleading guilty to assault following a bar brawl. The member for Falkirk admitted he was lucky to escape jail after he assaulted four others at a bar in the House of Commons. Conservative MP Stuart Andrew was one of those attacked. He says he hopes Mr Joyce can overcome any personal challenges he faces.
Indeed, this case does raise valid concerns in relation to the level of pastoral support and understanding available two MPs in Westminster who may be experiencing personal difficulties.
A teenager has been jailed for 7 years for attacking a Malaysian student during the London riots. 20-year-old Ashraf Rosli had been cycling to help a scared female friend when Bo Izagba punched him in the face. A former Roman Catholic priest who sexually abused young boys over nearly two decades has been jailed for 22 years. Alexander Bede Walsh carried out the attacks when he worked at children's homes and churches in Warwickshire, Staffordshire and Coventry. Michael Clifford came forward as a witness after living with the abuse for 30 years.
I trusted the man. I looked up to him as a priest at the time I was there. I was an altar boy in the home, and obviously anybody in authority with the Catholic Church, with the home, nuns, priests, you looked up to.
It's been confirmed a headless torso found in a London canal is that of former EastEnders actress Gemma McCluskey. Scotland Yard say she was last seen at a high-profile hospital opening ceremony. A 35-year-old man remains in police custody for questioning. That's the latest. I'm Claire Gregory.
Bristol is our community.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's weekly politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Councillor for St George West and leader of the Labour group on Bristol City Council, Peter Hammond. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, can we have economic growth whilst also protecting the environment? Destroying forest all looks good on the scale of GMP, so do we really need growth, and has it gone past the limit where we can have both growth and a decent environment? David Powell is here from Friends of the Earth. Plus, Bristol is the base for the Ministry of Defence procurement offices, but as one former defence contractor employee tells, the fraud has become systematic. Billions of pounds of public money going into contractors' pockets for doing nothing. And the people who are supposed to be stopping it don't want to prosecute. Robert McCartney spills the beans and the secrets of the MOD procurement fraud and asks, when will these billions of our money used for corporate criminal welfare, meaning our troops' equipment is either late or doesn't arrive at all, be stopped? That's in the second hour, after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 13 Celsius and plenty of sunny spells. Next week, highs up to 16 and a sunny week. Next weekend, that's the 17th and 18th of March, highs of 10 Celsius and fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests. And joining us is Councillor for St George West, leader of the Labour group on Bristol City Council, Peter Hammond. Hi, Peter. Welcome to Drive Time.
Nice to be here.
First of all, I should really ask you about the budget, which was passed last week. £27 million worth of cuts. I suppose the bare-faced facts of it are that if you'd have been in power, you'd have had to do the same.
No, there's different choices that need to be made. It's very difficult to work out because the level of the cuts is being dictated by the government. So, unless you're able to take on the government, then you have to make some choices. And there's no doubt or debate about the choices you make.
Well, the Lib Dem group are no more able to take on the government, surely, than you are as a Labour group.
Well, as I say, it's about choices. It's about choices you make. I'll give you an interesting statistic, for example, that last year we paid out to a group £4.7 million of taxpayers' money. And these were people called consultants. And there's widespread practice, certainly in Bristol and also in other parts of, you know, other local councils, of paying people at consultancy rates for work that should be paid for, if you like, at wage rates. That's something that we would need to look at and move funding across from that in my view, wasted expenditure across to providing services. And there's lots of other bits and pieces that need to be looked at. And our criticism is that they took, inverted commas, the easy option, and the cuts that they have made drastically affect living standards of people across Bristol.
The thing is, Peter, if a council's going to do anything, it does need to bring in those consultants as experts to make sure that anything that they're doing makes sense and works, don't they? They can't expect all of their in-house staff to have all the expertise necessary.
That's not the debate. The practice is that on many occasions, what people are called interim managers, i.e. when one person leaves, a senior manager leaves, then you've got to find a replacement. And the practice is to pay these people as consultants, not to pay them on a fixed term contract. And anybody that's got any experience of the way that these things work will know that consultants' day rates are phenomenal when you compare them with a comparable, if you like, salary for a job.
Now, before you got re-elected as a councillor at the last local elections, I suppose that was last May, you were out of politics, but you came in straight back in as leader. How did you manage that, Pete?
Well, when people say that you're out of politics, just because you don't have a title like MP or councillor doesn't mean that you've given up in terms of, if you like, being involved in activity. For a year prior to my re-election last year, I was the chair of the Bristol Labour Party. Which is, if you like, an unpaid role, certainly within the Labour Party. So I wasn't out of the public eye in that sense, and I certainly wasn't out of the eye of Labour councillors or Labour Party members.
OK, what about committees? What committees do you serve on now you're back into being a councillor again?
Well, of course, the only committee I actually serve it on is, as I'm a member of the Audit Committee, which is a, how can I put it, a political committee that actually looks at the books. And you find some very interesting things when you start to look at the books. You mentioned the budget process. Interestingly, the council's own auditors said, I think, of last year's budget process, basically, that the information provided to councillors and to the public was almost totally obscure and was exceedingly difficult to understand because of the way in which it was presented. Now, I'm a politician, but surely the people of Bristol and even our councillors should be given information so that they can make judgments, criticisms, or even support things that are easily understood. And this year's budget process within the council was no less difficult to actually follow, with obscure information, information delivered late, and even involving some of my councillors having to put freedom of information requests in to their own council to get information about what was in the budget and what the implications were. An absolutely appalling set of circumstances.
Now, doing an audit, really, seems, to many people, a bit of a pointless exercise, because what you're doing is you're going over stuff that's already happened, aren't you? If you do find anything that's wrong, you're shutting the door after the stable door after the horse has bolted, surely.
There is an element to that, but the role of audit is also to look at the process and procedures whereby, you know, the council conducts its financial affairs. And one of the reasons for audit is to actually look and check that the processes are right. And quite clearly, that audit report, and it was on page 39 of the Grant Thornton audit report, if anybody wants to look it up, you will find that particular reference. So from that point of view, it is important, and it is a proper scrutiny, because it's not just historic, even though it's called an audit committee, because audit should be going on continually, you know, as expenditure is being made. So it's not quite what it might appear to be.
Now, what about the sorts of information? Because I find this pretty staggering that you're saying that your councillors have to actually ask the City Council via Freedom of Information request for information. What information are the officers withholding from councillors?
I have to be careful here, because it's the atmosphere and it's the overall approach that's made. But for example, if you cut £50,000 off a budget, what does that mean in jobs? What does that mean in how something, a service, is delivered? What does it actually mean? Is 50,000 merely an exercise in cutting the number of paperclips that you use, or does it actually mean that a particular job or a particular service will be changed, and usually for the worse, usually, not always? What does that mean? And we couldn't find out what, if you like, a line on a piece of paper with a cut actually meant in terms of jobs, services, or whatever it was. It was exceedingly
But Peter, surely what a councillor does is they go and speak to that officer and ask them to explain, and the officer explains because the officer is working for the council.
That's the theory. I won't say anything further.
Okay, Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist, is joining us too. Martin, we normally talk about economics, but we're going to take a bit of a different tack this week. 6 deaths in Afghanistan. Now the total of people, of our servicemen over there and women killed, is up to over 400. There's been quite a big debate across the country about what Afghanistan is really all about.
Well, I think most people in Britain have already decided that it's all a waste of time, but the political class have got themselves, as they often do, the big wigs of all of the parties have got themselves into the situation where we can't back out, because otherwise we'd look silly. But most of the British population, including military people, I was speaking to ex-soldiers last weekend, they just think it's absolutely bonkers. And what are we doing there? And of course, what is actually happening is we are losing. That's what's happening. And when we finally pull out, as we eventually will, people will ask, well, what was that all about? And the answer will be nothing.
Well, I mean, we've also heard the bad news that since the Taliban were ousted 10 years ago, there's been a massive rise in the heroin production, or poppy production, opium production in Afghanistan. And it seems that, if anything, we may be having a counterproductive effect.
All right. Well, I mean, what I was talking about in what I just said there was about how ordinary people in this country perceive it. If you're asking me what it's really about, it's about geopolitics. It's about having bases which look threatening to the Chinese and the Iranians. It's about not losing face. It was originally about building a pipeline through Helmand Province, but they've never been able to do that because they've never been able to establish the security to build the pipeline. The powers that be have their reasons for being in Afghanistan, but it's not what they've told the ordinary people. And the ordinary people have been told a pack of lies about we're trying to catch bin Laden, we're trying to do this, we're trying to do that. They keep changing the story. And now, in fact, I think it's absolutely clear that the majority of British people, including service families, have basically... I mean, we chatted to an ex-British Army guy the other week, you and I, and he said, I've been around Afghanistan. He's an officer. I've been around Afghanistan talking to everybody, asking what we're doing here, and nobody's got any answers.
So why are we still there?
Because the Americans and they're out, have got a global plan, and we are still, we're marching to that drum.
What would happen if the British say, this may be very unlikely, but if we unilaterally said, well, we've had enough, we're coming, bringing our troops home?
Well, I think it would annoy the Americans enormously, but at the same time, quite a few other European countries have done just that. The Scandinavian countries just said that, sorry, we'd like to help you out, but my back's really bad and I can't do this anymore, and they've all quietly cried off. I think in Britain you've got this machismo in the senior officers, where they feel as if it will reflect on them if they withdraw and all the rest of it. I mean, some of the drivel that the senior officers have been coming out within the last week about there's light at the end of the tunnel, it's a terrible sacrifice, but it's going to be worth it in the end, it's just empty words.
Well, from Helmand to Avonmouth, and this one of the headlines in this week's Evening Post is a penalty threat over Bristol's open spaces. The long-running controversy over council plans to sell off green spaces in Bristol has been blown wide open again. At the first meeting to discuss the issue by one of the local neighbourhood partnerships this week, was charged with deciding which areas can be sold and which are kept. It emerged that the partnerships would be penalised financially for refusing to sell the most expensive plots of land. The Avonmouth and King's Weston Partnership was the first to discuss plots of land in their area. Members are keen to hang on to a particular area called Daisy Field and another area called Henacre Open Space, but a council official told the meeting that if these two areas, which just happened to be the most valuable on the table, were not released for sale, then the partnership would only receive 8% of the land sales, which amounts to about £50,000. If the partnership agreed to sell off the sites, then they would receive 70%, which could be about £750,000 to put towards local improvements. Peter, what do you make of this? Because I had no idea when we were going through all these sites that actually if we didn't sell them off, then it wasn't that the money wasn't going to be going into local projects. And I think in a way that there's an attempt here to hold a gun to the head of local people and say, well, if you want any improvements, you've got to sell off the valuable sites. And that ultimately means that it's the value to potential developers which is driving this whole process.
I wouldn't quarrel with the analysis that you've put forward. It's very, very clear that what has happened as a result of a lot of work that was done on behalf of local people to make sure that they had the final say, that the way in which the council or the political leadership of the council currently has clearly determined that they want the high value sites sold off in order to, if you like, add to the central pot of money. We're not too clear what the real imperative is behind this, because you know you have to be a bit suspicious about whether or not the real intention was to reinvest some of it back into, if you like, park land in a general sense, or whether it's a desperate scrabble for capital funds that the current administration is now engaged in. And that's appalling for local people. My local partnership in St George West, and we'll probably be faced with exactly the same dilemma when reports are, you know, presented to us, when we are going to be asked what we want to do, and I suspect the reaction will be exactly the same.
Well, it's not really a partnership if you've got the council on one side of the table saying we want to sell off the high value places, and then you've got local residents saying, but those are the ones we most love, on the other side of the table.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Neighbourhood Partnership is a partnership, a local one, but it's not proper partnership with, if you like, the, if you like, local people and the council. And what has happened, I think, is actually a betrayal of, if you like, the package that we thought we had agreed and the principles that we thought we had agreed as a result of, you know, cross-party discussions in the council. They appear to be betraying that sort of arrangement and that understanding that we had. It was for local people to decide, and if they did, they would have, if you like, the lion's share of any income from that to reinvest back in local projects. That appears now to be greatly under threat.
Now, former Labour councillor John Bees, Martin, said that the partnership was being penalised for holding on to its most prized parcels of open space. Don't you think there's a certain inevitability to this? Of course the council wants to sell off the ones which they're going to get most money for.
Well, what this reminds me of is what the Greeks are being told, which is you've got to sell off all of your assets to us because you've got no money. This is part of these pieces of parcels of land being sold off to developers is part of the austerity crisis. I suspect it probably is because they're trying to get their capital budgets sorted out, isn't it? And I understand we had Mark Weston on last week. And he was talking about that. I was talking to him about that the council has actually borrowed quite a lot of money, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I find that rather strange that we've got a Liberal Democrat administration which is trying to borrow money in order to kind of soften the blow at local level because of central government won't spend the money. I mean, that's left hand and right hand not knowing what each other is doing. And ultimately, we've got to get away from this austerity policy, because this austerity policy is a disaster on every front, including for green spaces.
John, Pete, could you give us an idea of how your administration would handle something like this? Because you do need to raise some money from selling off this land, I would imagine.
Capital financing, without being too sort of technical about it, is actually one of the keys to taking Bristol forward. And I have to say that the council in their budget agreed to borrow an extra 50 odd million pounds. Mm. And actually, we think the principle of that is right in the yes. sense of investing. What we don't think is right is what is happening here, which is having borrowed money by that particular route at very cheap interest rates at the moment. It's a good deal in terms of borrowing. But now what they're trying to do is not only do that, which is a right approach, and the wrong approach is trying to penalise the people of Bristol for wanting to hang on to stuff that they really, really value in terms of, you know, green open space. And they're trying to garner the money in by this particular route, almost sort of sneaking it through, if you like. The agreement that we all thought we had has now been reinterpreted in this particular way. That's dishonest. That's clearly and extremely dishonest.
Well, it sounds like there'll be a few fiery neighbourhood partnership meetings to come for the Liberal ruling, not coalition, no, the ruling Liberal group on the City Council.
Well,
they'll have some explaining to do.
A coalition now, a coalition between the Tories, despite their apparent disagreements on bits and pieces, and the Liberal Democrats, because it's their budget that they voted through back, you know, only a few days ago. So they're equally responsible, even though they pretend they're not.
So what did you do to change what the budget was, going back to this budget from last week? You know, what would your party do to tweak it?
We put forward a number of ideas that we wanted to use to demonstrate a different way of thinking about things fundamentally. Two of our schemes, one was actually a discount for pensioners, the over 75s in particular households. Not a large amount of money, but a demonstration that we wanted to do something for older people. Another one of our proposals, half of which was accepted, was a, if you like, a travel or book fund for young people who, if you like, lost their education maintenance allowance, i.e. you could have a discounted travel scheme or you could have some academic books to encourage young people, A, to use public transport, which is another objective, but also to meet a real problem, because when the EMAs went, college admissions collapsed, well, I would say collapsed, went down by about 15%, and the biggest reason people were saying, youngsters were saying, they couldn't afford the travel or they couldn't afford the books. So we gave some different examples of doing something different. But you can't rewrite, as an opposition party, a budget of £367 million. It's difficult, given the problems I told you about earlier. They're just two of the ideas. We also promoted an amendment that was accepted to give some extra money in Olympic year for young people's sports. That was accepted. So there's three things that we'd put forward. We also had an amendment on the issue of the Severn Beach line to put in an extra service on the Severn Beach line, which runs almost past this building. Eventually, we didn't have to do it because, as a result of pressure that we'd put on, along with, I have to say, with the Green Party, that the administration found miraculously some more money from somewhere to actually introduce it. We welcome it, but those are the sort of different things that we wanted to do, just to demonstrate there are different ways of doing things and different thinking, and to demonstrate our support for supporting, shall we say, at this stage, some of the more vulnerable people in our communities.
Okay, now on to the conspiracy of the week, I suppose we'd have to call it, which is large sums of money being offered to drop the Ashton Vale Stadium challenge. The anonymous resident, who, this is in the Evening Post, who halted plans for a new £92 million Bristol City Football Club stadium at Ashton Vale, was allegedly offered substantial sums of money to drop his legal challenge, a judge has been told. Last month, the Evening Post reported that the man, who cannot be named because of a court order, had told the court that he no longer wanted to continue with his legal challenge against the building of the stadium. Land in Ashton Vale, where Bristol City wants to build a new stadium, is being opposed by a legal challenge. Former Labour councillor Peter Crispin, who's heading the campaign group Save Ashton Vale Environment, said, "I have no doubt about the intimidation. I cannot comment on the other matter about the offer of money because the legal process is still ongoing." And Bristol City Football Club's chief executive Guy Price declined to comment last night while court proceedings were ongoing. Now, Peter, this has been a long-running debacle, really, whether this greenfield site is going to be turned into a stadium. And it does sound like there's maybe some underhand tactics going on here to really buy off the opposition. Financially buy them off.
I have to be honest, it's really very difficult to work out what exactly is going on in reality. I mean, we've got these allegations, both of, if you like, I suppose, physical intimidation and, if you like, financial bribery. It's very difficult to determine what the truth is behind this, but the whole thing is, as you called it, it's a debacle, and the council has contributed in a major way to this being a debacle. What should have happened, when, if you like, new evidence was available, was the whole lot should have been referred back to the first inspector and said, here you know, crudely speaking, here you are, take a look at this, what do you think about new evidence that apparently has come forward, what do you think about it? Instead, you and I are paying thousands upon thousands upon thousands of pounds to argue this out in a court of law, when I think it could have been resolved far more fairly by, said, new evidence, go back, look at it again to the inspector and see what the inspector says. And I have to say that public pronouncements by prominent members of the Liberal Democrat administration in press releases have not helped the situation in any way, shape or form. They should have kept their mouths shut. So now's the time, I would actually, the council should do it now, forget the legal process and say, we'll re-employ the inspector, here's all the evidence that's been submitted, what do you think about this, and then follow through what the inspector says from that. That's the fairest way of dealing with it.
But I mean, if I wanted to build a shed or even a summer house on that field, I would be refused planning permission. But it seems that because someone has a lot of money in their back pocket, they may be able to build a massive multi-seater stadium and, of course, massively up the value of the land. The land, which at the moment, without its planning permission, will be worth a few thousand pounds, suddenly becomes worth millions. Well, I mean, this is like a way of printing money, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I suppose you could look at it that particular way. I know the planning processes are somewhat interesting when they work their way through. But, of course, the council, this is not a political decision, it's given planning consent. You know, that's done on a non-apolitical basis. So that's what you've got. Of course, it doesn't stop anybody getting planning consent from anywhere in Bristol. You could get planning consent on a bit of property you don't even own. That's how bizarre the planning law actually is. And it's not unknown for that to happen as well.
So maybe the Lansdowne money, which has been saved from him being a tax exile over in the Channel Islands, is being used to bribe people to stop their legal complaints. That is certainly what's implied by this article. Martin?
Well, I mean, I'm listening to what both of you are saying. I haven't been following it as closely as Peter has. But, I mean, if somebody's offering money to people to withdraw a legal complaint, that's a criminal matter, isn't it? Basically, that's bribery. And, you know, somebody who's been offering that money should be wondering whether their collar is going to be felt.
Well, OK, interesting way to end that one. The 40 jobs are to go in Bristol as Remploy closes its sites. The Bristol factory, which employs and trains disabled people, is set to close with a loss of about 40 jobs. The government announced that Remploy is proposing to close 36 of its 54 factories around the country, including its site on Kingsland Trading Estate in St Phillips. The Minister for Disabled People, Maria Miller, said the Remploy board was proposing to close the sites by the end of the year because they were unlikely to achieve an independent financial viability. Peter?
This is quite a difficult issue around some principles here, and I'm not excusing what the government's doing in any shape or form, but the debate is around disabled people and their ability to be able to earn a living, and there's two arguments here. One talks about the provision of specific employment opportunities for disabled people. That's one strand of an argument. The other strand of the argument is, should disabled people be, if you like, accommodated in, if you like, ordinary businesses? We know the reality of that, in fact, is it is actually extremely difficult, despite what the law says, in many circumstances, for disabled people to find employment. And discrimination sometimes is difficult to prove, but goes on. So it's in grave difficulty. I think, on balance, that this is actually an attack on disabled people, and we can all have a debate around some of the principles, but the reality of it is that many disabled people will not be able to access employment in a time of recession. In particular, they're not going to be able to access employment if they're thrown out of employment in Remploy factories in Bristol, and indeed in other parts of the country.
But Peter, we can't afford this anymore. That's the long and short of it.
Well, I noticed in the press release that allegedly support for disabled people to go into employment is allegedly only £2,900 from the state in order to support this. And I can't remember the figures for per employee. Somewhere in the 14,000s, they allege, is the cost. If you've listened to the debate, the unions representing the Remploy employees have clearly said that they're not averse to discussion, but clearly there is a lot of, shall we say, waste in terms of management structures and in the way that these businesses are organised that should be dealt with before even considering, you know, penalising disabled people in this particular way. So you can make figures tell you anything if you really want to, if you're determined to close them.
Now, Kevin Hepworth is the Unite the Union representative for Remploy workers, and I spoke to him earlier this week.
Yeah, my name's Kevin Hepworth. I'm a full-time officer of Unite the Union, and I have national responsibility for our members in Remploy. Remploy is a network of factories and employment services offices set up shortly after the Second World War by the Labour government, and originally to provide employment for disabled soldiers, sailors, Air Force personnel, etc. after the war. That expanded and grew and became a normal, if you like, employer of disabled people. At the moment, Remploy is the single largest employer of disabled workers in the country, and we're absolutely devastated that this government have finally decided to pull the plug and close Rentley. This will mean some 2,500 disabled workers over the next 18 months potentially becoming unemployed at a time of obviously very high unemployment. Rentley factories are modern, high-tech factories manufacturing everything from furniture for schools and libraries. Rentley's the largest manufacturer of school furniture in the country, high quality desks, bookshelves, etc. They're the sole supplier for manufacturing of Quickdom, which is the suits that the armed forces personnel wear to protect themselves against chemical and nuclear warfare. Rentley, the sole manufacturer of those. They also have a very good network of what we call e-cycle, where they take in computers, completely data cleanse them so your computer is completely clear of anything that you've used it for. They can then refurbish them and they can be then sold on to those people who can't afford new computers. They also have a recycling of electronic goods where they'll take in your old fridges, cookers, etc., refurbish them and again make them available at low cost for those people who struggle in society to pay for new. They've got some of the best printing works, producing packaging equipment, boxes, etc., for industry. So they've got a whole range of very skilled workers. The jobs that will be on offer if they close the factories usually turn out to be lower skilled jobs in places like Tesco, etc. And we accept that people need to do those jobs. But to actually take somebody who's got a disability, who's trained up to do a highly skilled job, and give them a job stacking shelves in a supermarket, is just unbelievably short-sighted by this government. But I think it's a bit rich to say we can afford to help people abroad to improve their lot, but we can't look after our own disabled people. It's a relatively small amount in the overall scheme of things. I know the government say it costs 20-something thousand pounds per head of disabled worker, but what that figure fails to take into account is the tax, the national insurance contributions people make, what they actually contribute to local economies through their spending power. And it also ignores the fact that if they're unemployed, most of these people will then be not paying their local council tax. They'll be living council tax free, so that's a drain on income to the council. So the figure is vastly overestimated in an attempt to justify the closures.
Now, that was Kevin Hepworth from Unite the Union talking about Rempoy. Martin, I wonder if you can give us your take on this, because one of the points he's making there is that we're still giving money, sort of overseas aid money, but we're not prepared to look after people, disabled people here in Britain. And also, of course, they were not responsible for the financial crisis, were they?
No, I don't think your Unite fellow was saying that overseas aid should be cut to keep Rempoy going. I think that's a slight misapprehension. I mean, basically, what you do if you close these factories is these people then go on to sickness benefit, and then they go on, if they seem to be available for or capable of working, they then go on to unemployment benefit. So you're going to pay people to do nothing instead of paying people to do something which is obviously they've done very successfully for many years.
Well, since the World War II.
Well, exactly, and I don't suppose any of these people are very happy about being sacked. What about them? I mean, I understand that the argument behind this is that we want to get away from segregated employment for disabled people, and that the money it's not supposed to be saving money; they're supposed to be transferring the money so that they can give lots more disabled people support to be in mainstream employment. Now, that is just a fantasy economics in the current circumstances. What will happen when these factories close is these people will go on to sickness benefit, and there they will stay, and they'll carry on soaking up housing benefit and whatever, and they will also have not be working. I mean, you should actually be providing subsidised jobs for everybody, not just for the unemployed. There's no benefit in keeping people unemployed. We used to argue this in Eastern Europe in the 1980s and 1990s. There's no point sacking people and putting them on benefits. You're better to keep them in work, even if they're losing money. Keep them in work because you're actually getting something out of them.
But what about my point about punishing disabled people for the crimes of the bankers?
Well, indeed, absolutely. I mean, it's a pretty shameful thing. I mean, I suppose that these people are quite happy to work in the places they work, and they'll be very unhappy to lose their jobs.
Also, very skilled people.
Exactly. I mean, it's just vandalism.
There's a double whammy, actually. Which, if you cast your mind back to government proposals to change, if you like, what I call the incapacity benefit arrangements as well. So not they won't be receiving eventually what they would be receiving at the moment, but with the restrictions on benefit payments for people, you know, long-term sick, incapacity, and the reductions there that are beginning to bite. So they'll be thrown out of work, and even the benefit and the support that they will get will be cut as a result of this as well. It's lunacy.
It is lunacy, because also the macroeconomics of this is all these little cuts add up to big drain of demand out of the economy. The economy is hanging on a cliff edge as we speak. The last thing you should do, and I don't think the Labour front bench have really got their heads around this, you don't cut public expenditure at all in this situation. Don't argue about what we need to cut. Say, no, we don't cut anything. Not keeping the level of public expenditure up doesn't solve your problem. You're still in an international financial crisis. But cutting public expenditure is actually counterproductive. And the coalition government are going to get an economics lesson whether they like it or not. All of these little cuts add up to big cuts, and then the economy is going to stall or fall off a cliff. And all the answer to that is then quantitative easing to keep the banks afloat. It's absolutely ludicrous, and people are going to see through it very shortly.
Well, from the victims of the crime to the perpetrators and the Royal Bank of Scotland, we had questions asked about them in Prime Minister's Questions this week on Wednesday in the House of Commons. So let's have a listen to that.
The Royal Bank of Scotland has recently axed another 300 jobs, mostly in Edinburgh and London. However, the jobs have not gone completely. They've all been outsourced to India. The Prime Minister and the government are the biggest shareholders on behalf of the stakeholders. So when will the Prime Minister stand up to RBS and prevent these needless job losses in the UK?
Well, I think the most important thing we have to do with the Royal Bank of Scotland is to recognise that the last government put in, on behalf of the country, £45 billion into that bank. That is £2,500 for every working family in the country. And the most important thing is we get that money back. We need RBS to return to health. It's got to deal with its bad loans. It's got to deal with the trouble it got into. It's got to grow the rest of its business. It's therefore, and then we'll get into a position where we can return people the money that they put into that bank. That's what matters most of all.
Well, I mean, that's just another example of fantasy economics, isn't it? I mean, there's no real prospect of this bank ever being returned to the private sector, but we've all got to pretend that it is. Did you see Vince Cable's leaked letter this week? And he's saying, well, perhaps the Royal Bank of Scotland should be turned into a nationalised bank to compete with the private sector, and therefore, of course, could follow social objectives like keeping work in Britain. But of course, that means that we're out of the universe of private banking, and we're moving into the new socialised banking system that we're going to have eventually, one way or another. Everybody still thinks that these banks are somehow going to be sold back to the private sector. They're living in cloud cuckoo land. They are never going back to the private sector, ever.
Peter Hammond, leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council. 300 jobs at Royal Bank of Scotland, which we own, just being farmed out to India.
Well, I think the important thing is that it's about the loss of jobs. Actually, in one sense, we should be careful about saying that these jobs are going somewhere else. Otherwise, we get involved in other stupid arguments, unfortunately. It's very interesting, just picking up on some of the comments that Martin made. Well, of course, one of the roots of letting banks go back to the private sector is, of course, the bargain price that Virgin paid for the remains of Northern Rock. That was the best price, allegedly, that the government could get for selling that back into the private sector. Don't pass any comment on Virgin. You can all draw your, you know, have your own views about that. But very clearly, what the government has done is refused other options for, if you like, making banking far more of a social enterprise. For example, why didn't they look at proposals that were put forward for returning some of these institutions back as cooperative institutions, actually working for people in the same way as the co-op bank, the principles of the co-op bank are there? Why didn't they look at that? There's a clear political agenda which is dictated by basically ensuring that their friends, the people that bank the Tory party, make the most out of the situation that we've got.
But Peter, you say, talking about silly arguments you get into, are you in favour then of offshoring, that is to say sacking people here because you can employ people a bit cheaper abroad?
No, very clearly I'm not, but some people will use this as an argument, if you like, a xenophobic argument about, you know, people from other countries. For working for some British companies, you have to recognise abroad is actually very good employment in the terms of their economy and their wage rates. So we just need to be a bit cautious about that. The clear decision is to get rid of 300 jobs in this country, which could well be done effectively and efficiently by working people in this country in need of a job.
Well, Joan Ruddock is now an MP, and she also put a question to David Cameron on Wednesday.
In Joan Ruddock.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister is proud of his welfare reforms. Can he... Can he look me in the eye and tell me he is proud of the decision to remove all disability benefits from a 10-year-old child who can hardly walk, who cannot toilet herself because she has cerebral palsy? Is he truly proud?
This government is not cutting the money that's going into disability benefits. We're replacing disability living allowance with the personal independence payment. And as someone who's actually filled out the form for disability living allowance and had a child with cerebral palsy, I know how long it takes to fill in that form. We're going to have a proper medical test so people who are disabled, who need that help, get it more quickly.
Fantasy Island, really, isn't it, that type of response? Very clearly, and not only, if you like, MPs and Labour MPs are tackling what the government is effectively doing, but across the, if you like, the disability sector, people are extremely angry at the way in which the government is manipulating, if you like, payments for disability and support for disabled people. I took part in the demonstration I think it was before Christmas, you know, the hardest hit rally, which we was, as councillors were proud to support in terms of what is actually happening. And the reaction from not only organisations, but actually just from disabled people, they're horrified at what is in fact going on and the restrictions that the government is placing on support for people who are disabled. It's appalling, and it's Fantasy Island, that response.
But I'm afraid, surely, Peter, this is the new reality we're living in with the financial situation the way it is. We simply cannot afford to pay disability benefits to people like this, as Joan is saying. I mean, it may be upsetting, it may not be what we want to do, but we just can't afford it anymore.
Oh, you're just trying to provoke me, aren't you, Tony? You know, into some response. You and I know that support for people who are disabled, support for the vulnerable, is a keystone, actually, of a civilised society. We are able to afford it. There is money in Britain. I forget, Martin will tell me, in the rankings of wealthy countries where we currently sit, we are not a poor country. It's actually the situation, the financial manipulation by bankers and financiers and others that have led us to the, so say, recession and the mess that we're actually in. We are a wealthy country. It's just the way that that wealth is being used and being manipulated, clearly for the benefit of those who already have the money rather than the rest of us that don't.
Sounds like Peter's picking up on what I was saying the other week, which is government by the millionaires for the millionaires.
Yes, and I think the other point I would make, which reiterates what I was saying earlier, all these little cuts and trying to save money here and there is actually idiotic. You don't, in fact, want to be saving money at this stage of a financial crisis. The government should, in fact, be the employer and support of last resort for the economy. And what you should be doing at the moment, I don't think we can increase public expenditure without increasing taxes on the wealthy, but you shouldn't be cutting public expenditure. And you're talking about the council borrowing at the very low rates. The government could borrow at very low rates and keep all of these benefits in place, and it's a big distraction. So we're talking about the work-shy people on disability benefits, and we're not talking about the people paying backhanders to try and get football stadiums built and paying their taxes in Jersey. Now, this is the point, that 1% of the population of Britain controls something like 50% of the wealth. The bottom third has nothing at all, and that's the reality. And it's got worse under both Conservative and New Labour governments. And as Peter says, this is a very wealthy country. And in fact, the top 5% have done fantastically well out of the bubble and the bust. They're still doing fantastically well out of it, but of course they want to distract us all from that by picking on the most vulnerable in society. And you know what? They're going to get their comeuppance come the next election, I hope.
Let's go back for our final visit then to Westminster and a final clip. And this is from MP Sharon Hodgson.
This is Sharon Hodgson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can I ask the Prime Minister, is it true, and I quote, "The problem is that policy has been run by two public school boys who don't know what it's like to go to the supermarket and to put things back on the shelves because they can't afford it for their children's lunchboxes. What's worse, they don't care either. Not my words, Mr. Speaker, but the words of Conservative MP for Mid Bedfordshire.
I would have thought, coming from the North East, she should be celebrating the fact that Nissan are going to be building their new car. Instead of whatever the nonsense it was she read out.
Well, nonsense or otherwise, that was said by a Conservative MP up in the North East. It seems maybe, Martin, that David Cameron is losing touch with some of his backbenchers.
Yes, and I think, the Conservative Party is a broad church as the Labour Party is. And I think of Conservatives of a previous generation, as Edward Heath, for example, or Macmillan, and they, although they came from wealthy backgrounds, understood very well that, you don't go around kicking sand in the face of the poor and the underprivileged. And there's a nasty element in some parts of the current Tory front bench, which actually takes pleasure in rubbing the faces of the poor in the dust. And I think that they're misjudging the public mood very dramatically if they think they're going to get away with it with that sort of attitude.
Well, I can't but agree with what Martin is saying, but it's also interesting to comment actually on the state of the Tory party, not only around this particular issue, but there are very clear divisions now within the Conservative group of MPs, and a clear division, I think, growing between their backbenchers and their front bench. But some of the developments in the back bench are pretty frightening as well, in terms of what some of the Tory backwoodsmen, the really aggressive, nasty people, would like to see actually happening. So if Cameron's not careful, he might face some severe difficulties as the year goes on, around the tone of this debate, but also around the tone of some of the way that his backbenchers are extremely unhappy that, if you like, he's not being tough enough.
Yeah. Martin, you are grimacing there and nodding.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, we have everybody on this show, as you know, and when we have Conservatives on the show, I always try to talk to them, because at the Conservative Party, as I said to Mark Weston last week, the government in this country that built the most council houses was the Conservative government of the 1950s. Yeah. Norman St. John Stevens, who's just died, he was kicked out of Margaret Thatcher's cabinet because he didn't agree with the kind of things David Cameron is now doing. And I call upon decent Conservatives, who are Conservative, to be Conservative. Don't destroy Remploy, which has been there for donkey's years. That's Conservatism. Not charging around copying what's going on in the United States of America, where if you look at the Republican presidential primaries, it's like lunatics taking over the asylum. And I think that they're getting increasingly divorced from reality, and I think reality is going to hit them in the face like a wet fish, because the economy is about to go down the drain and the deficit's about to go through the roof, and we're going to lose our credit rating. And at that point, all of this stuff will be shown up for the trivial economic illiteracy that it actually is.
Well, the latest whiz scheme from the government is the police are set to outsource investigating crimes and patrols to private firms. West Midlands and Surrey Police are asking private security firms to bid for contracts worth £1.5 billion over the next 7 years to run some services currently carried out by officers, such as investigating crime and patrolling neighbourhoods. It was revealed the private security firms have been asked to bid for contracts to run some services currently carried out by ordinary police officers. The successful firms would take on a wide range of responsibilities, detaining suspects, responding to incidents, although they would not be able to actually make arrests, The Guardian reported. Also, alongside that, private firms are to run police stations. A private security firm has signed a contract to build, design and help run a police station. G4S signed the deal, thought to be the first of its kind, with Lincolnshire Police Authority. Now, we're also facing big changes to the way the police is overseen, Peter, with the abolition of police authorities and the election later in this year of the first police commissioners. That is one single person who has oversight of the police.
Yeah, there are some really severe changes that's going to affect, if you like, policing across this country. And by the way, I was appalled to read that these new police commissioners will be paid somewhere between £85,000 to £100,000 a year in their job, only have to do it part-time. Mind you, when you think about it, you know, you come in on Monday morning, maybe the chief job of the new police commissioner will be to visit the police dog unit down just outside Bristol. On the second day, it'll be the horse unit. We'll find out it's in the same place. So what actually is that individual going to be responsible for. But I find it appalling paying that sort of money for a part-time, effectively what could be a part-time job.
What about this principle, though, of the these police patrols and crime investigation being carried out by private firms?
Well, I could be cynical and say that I thought we'd contracted out some of our policing to News International already, but maybe that's an unfair unfair comment to make a private company. But you know, I can see Martin smiling. He might probably agree with me. But
well, I think the thing about the administration of justice, especially in a social crisis like this, is the police have to be seen to be above the fray, dealing with people on a fair basis, with no private profit involved, no hint of having an agenda other than doing the right thing for the people. And if you're going to politicise policing by electing police commissioners, what they're hoping, of course, is that in the shires and the suburbs, the middle class will turn out to vote Tory in these roles, and the people in the inner cities who we struggle to get to vote anyway won't bother. And then, of course, they're hoping that they will get Daily Mail-led policing. But, of course, they've not introduced it in Northern Ireland because we've just spent 30 years depoliticising the police force. You could easily have elections for police commissioner in Derry, which will bring up a Sinn Féiner, and elections for a police commissioner in Belfast, which will bring up an ex-UDA man. That would be great, wouldn't it? Fantastic. Except we've just spent 30 years trying to get rid of that, but the Tories are going to reintroduce it to Britain. Politicise the police force. Fantastic idea. Get ready for the bombs under the cars, eh? What a joke.
Peter, what about this? I mean, this police station in Lincolnshire is due to open 1st of April, which is run by G4S, running the whole thing.
Well, an interesting development. I find it actually slightly worrying that actually we only learn about it now. Why weren't we aware of this in general terms, you know, a long time ago, in which case people would have some awareness? Part of the problem has been, when I was a councillor in Southmead, and it's got worse since then, the Southmead police station was hardly open to the public in any realistic sense of the word. The opening hours were extremely restricted, so, you know, even if you had to go in there on, you know, if you like, on for whatever purpose, you couldn't actually get into it. I suspect that it won't be profitable to open this station in Lincolnshire beyond a few restricted hours in terms of serving, you know, the public and the community.
But is there a conflict of interest between the profit motive that G4S have and the actual job of policing?
Well, if you think that serving people and serving the public and public service is the motivation and what actually the police are part of, it's a public service, then the role of private companies, etc., own it to make money, not necessarily directly to serve the public, is exceedingly worrying and should not really be the basis. And I agree with Martin. Of all the services that we've got, we expect the police to, if you like, deal fairly and objectively with any situation that they find. And police forces vary over the country in the way that they do that. And some are actually reasonably good. I'm worried about the profit motive in terms of being introduced directly into policing. And as I quipped earlier around the role of big commercial organisations such as News International, that didn't have a contract but appeared to be running, if you like, the relationships of the police with not only the media but with the rest of us, that's the worrying aspect.
We've also got this organisation Southwest One, which is in it covers the Avon and Somerset police area, also for North Somerset District Council. Apparently they also run some of their services. They've been privatised. They do the sort of back office work, things like payroll, that kind of thing. I mean, surely that is actually quite a positive thing.
Well, if you followed the saga of Southwest One, you will now see that one of the keen promoters of Southwest One, which was the Somerset County Council, are now saying that they want to get out of the contract because it hasn't delivered in their terms the sort of service that they were going to deliver. And of course, Avon and Somerset are one of the partners that use Southwest One. So it hasn't been a very good experience, I'd suggest, for those councils.
And the police themselves have been saying that the software that Southwest One have brought in just simply doesn't work. This is simple stuff for doing things like expenses.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm just saying there's a prime example of private investment or private business being introduced to a public service, which has proved to be less than successful.
Well, one would have thought that probably the best idea is not to then roll it out across the whole police force if it hasn't worked in one particular area. Anyway, final story this week, MP's fury as top Catholic calls gay marriages as immoral as slavery. This is in the Evening Post on Wednesday. Britain's most senior Catholic has been branded grossly offensive and stuck in the time warp by Bristol Bristol MP by a Bristol MP in the growing row over gay marriage. Stephen Williams said he was astounded by comments from Cardinal Keith O'Brien, who suggested that same-sex unions were as immoral as slavery. Well, I don't think he exactly said that. He said marriage was as marriage was as immoral as slavery. Martin.
Well, I mean, leaving aside the arguments about this, that's ridiculous hyperbole, isn't it? As immoral as slavery, really? I mean, it invites ridicule, doesn't it? There's an issue here, which people have got strong feelings about, but to call it as immoral as slavery, to call people getting married who are gay, is just way over the top, isn't it?
Peter, I mean, it does seem like this, if this does come in, we will be changing the dictionary definition of what the word marriage means. Is that okay?
I have no problem with the issue, and indeed many Christians, like myself, have no issue. In fact, there's been a great degree of support, certainly across some parts of the Church of England, not all parts and not from the leadership, but from even the new Dean of St Paul's has made a very clear public statement that he's supportive of the concept of gay marriage, and he said we should be welcoming marriage as something positive, whether you choose to be married or not. And I actually think that the Dean's got the right idea, and his values, I think, generally for Christians, are the right ones.
Well, let's have a listen to what you, the people of Bristol, think. Marina Morris has been out asking you.
The government is considering gay marriage. Why not keep civil partnership, which have the same legal status?
Well, I believe gay people should have the same rights as everybody else, so I'll be fully supporting.
We should extend the right to marriage to gay couples. I know people feel very strongly to the contrary, and that they believe that marriage is something that should only exist between a man and a woman. The implication of that is that the relationship between the gay couple is therefore deemed to be lesser than a relationship between a straight couple.
That marriage is a tradition and gay people can have civil partnerships, and marriage is a traditionally between a man and a wife. Just keeping civil partnerships is fine.
I don't care about marriage in general. I don't think two people need to be married to be together. And yeah, civil partnership should have exactly the same status as being married.
Yeah, obviously keep civil partnerships, but I think people should be free to do whatever they want. If they want to actually get married, then why not? You know, this is 2012.
I don't know why you don't keep civil partnership with the same legal status.
Can gay couples bring up children as well as a heterosexual couple?
I don't see why not. If there's plenty of gay people adopting, it'd become more normal and it wouldn't subject the kids to any bullying within school. A lot of people are brought up with single parent families, and I see having two blokes do just as good a job.
Yes, as well or as badly, I don't think it makes any difference at all. These days people's characters and their personalities aren't necessarily completely defined by gender stereotypes anyways. You can have a mixed couple who provide as much as a gay couple could, and vice versa. So I think probably the difficulty might come from external pressures where people feel that you know, their children might be discriminated against. No, I think there are a lot of straight couples that make a terrible mess of it, and I don't see why no one tries to restrict them from having children.
I don't really see any issue with two men or two women bringing up a children. I don't really think that's about having strong male or female role models. It's just about being brought up in the right way with the correct morals, being brought up to be a good person, and you don't need two parents of both sex for that. I have plenty of friends who've been brought up by single parents, and they've just been brought up by either a woman or a man, and it doesn't make a difference.
Anyone can be a parent if they want to. I don't see what the problem would be with gay couples. There are a lot of single parents out there in the modern world. What's the difference between, for example, a single mother bringing up a child on her own and a gay couple with two men or two women? You know, what is the difference?
I can see positives and negatives. On the one hand, I'd say why not. On the other hand, well, I couldn't imagine having two dads and not having a mum. You know, personally, I think, you know, mother's very important for the child. So
yes, why not? Lots of children grow up without two parents at all.
Well, that's all for the first hour. Thanks to this week's guest, Councillor for St George West and Leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, Peter Hammond.
Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky.